podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome back to part two of Buzz Podcast, our Al Pacino tribute special. I say part two, but we've just been talking here. We've only hit 1990. Maybe it'll be a part seven. I'm not really sure how this is going to go, but we're going to give it a go now and start with the year 1990. And when I say we, of course, I mean myself, Trevor, co-host Dave Hendrick, as we have a look at the career of Al Pacino. Really enjoyed doing part one, the memories, talking about the many, many movies, the endless rabbit holes down which we could have gone and tried to avoid. But this decade here is going to present something of a challenge for the chatty types like us, because there's just seemingly too many things to talk about. I've no idea how we're going to manage this, Dave. Never mind doing the following two decades as well. But we'll give it a go. And let me start and bring you in on the year 1990, which sees him assaying the role of the local stigmatic, which was a play that he had previously been in. And this, I think, a movie in which he directed, I'm pretty sure he directs and he's involved in the production of it. It is one that is not necessarily a massive success for him. It's a bit stagey. I don't know that it works necessarily as a film. People know Paul Guilfoyle from CSI. They'll recognize his face from that, at least. But in this year, he also has Dick Tracy, which ends up being a bit of a mega hit and earning him an Oscar nomination, and The Godfather Part 3, which we alluded to briefly. So in other words, off the back of Sea of Love, he's into two huge budget films, and perhaps his star on the rise again in terms of his place in the Hollywood pantheon, how he's thought about, where he gets cast. It's weird to think that Al Pacino could find himself in a place where he's not, like, you know, one of the first names everyone thinks about. But apparently, you know, off the back of that run of Deerfield, Justice for All, Cruising, Author, then there was the hit that was Scarface, but then there's Revolution and a big four-year gap until Sea of Love. And it does seem to have revitalized him in terms of almost every year after this, then there's something massive. There's a big old, big paying role for him in this decade, Dave.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, the local stigmatic does not work. I'm sure the play is phenomenal. The film doesn't work. And, you know, it was something he wanted to do and something he was heavily involved in, the making of, not just the acting of, but it just didn't work. But Dick Tracy works. Now, as I said in the first one, he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. I'm not sure I would have gone that far with it, but it is a very good film, and he is very good in it.
Do you want to tell people about the type of film it is? Because some people now might go on our reference here and go and look up Dick Tracy and expect to see Al Pacino being Al Pacino, whereas there's a very specific thing that we need to mention here about this performance and the way in which he looks on screen.
Yeah. Yeah, he looks odd. he doesn't look like Al. Well, he does, but he doesn't at the same time. Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's an almost, like, obviously it's based on the comic strip of the 1930s.
Yeah.
And it's very much, it's almost done in that comic book style.
Absolutely.
Like, even some of the lighting and some of the way scenes are shot, they're almost done in that kind of comic book style. It's a good film. Like, it's absolutely worth the watch, and the cast is absolutely ridiculous. Like, you know, you've got Dustin Hoffman in, you know, a supporting role, William Forsythe in the same type of thing, Mandy Patinkin, who's obviously had incredible success on TV, in the same type of role. Like, James Caan is in it in a bit part. Like, the cast is phenomenal. Pacino's really good. But Yeah, it's not the film you're expecting it to be. Like, it really isn't. It very much leans into the comic book, almost cartoonish at times, way of going about it. And that, I suppose, could be a bit off-putting for some people. But I have to say, I wouldn't rewatch it every year, but it's certainly one I've seen multiple times, and, you know, I always enjoy it.
I imagine the cast is down to Warren Beatty, who's sort of Hollywood royalty and a massive player in that decade we were talking about with such fondness, the 70s, and, you know, kind of larger than life figure. And in this one, he directs, produces and stars in. And it's a, you know, like you said, it's a stylized comic book tribute. And people want to work with Warren Beatty. And, you know, he's around about 50 odd here, 53, 54, 52, something around that kind of age. And Beatty's famously, like, ridiculously handsome, pretty man. That's what he traded off in the early days. And then, you know, there are more, obviously more heavyweight performances as time passes. And I feel like this possibly might have been like almost like a last hurrah for him, a kind of look at me thing, vanity project. And he's the hero. He's the key role. He's directing, producing, starring. And, you know, as a result, then he can call in a few favors. And that cast, like you said, is ridiculous. With perhaps the solitary exception of Madonna, I think.
Yeah.
That might be fair to say.
Yeah, I think so. And like, it's like, look, she's not terrible in it, but she's not an actress. I know she's given it a go over the years. She's been in a bunch of different things. But the bottom line is she's not an actress.
And famously, you can tell, yeah. And famously only took $35,000 as a kind of almost nominal fee to just be in it, which I do actually admire as a kind of, look, you know, I just really want to have a go at this. So, look, you know, whatever. And again, maybe I'm just being a bit sniffy there, but like you say, it is kind of apparent that she isn't an actress. Of course, the other big picture from 1990 is The Godfather Part 3. We've spoken about this a bit, and it just warrants another couple of observations, I think, on a couple of levels. You can see what he was trying to do, and there is the sort of passing of the torch nominally to Andy Garcia.
Yeah.
And I like that. And I think Andy Garcia was a guy who could conceivably easily have taken on that role. And, you know, his turn in The Untouchables is great, and he does have that star presence. He's obviously, you know, typical handsome leading man type, but he does have that kind of grittiness to him as well. It comes across in this role. There are a couple of sort of flaws that haunt this film. And we talked about a casting decision there in terms of putting Madonna in Dick Tracy, but Francis Coppola casting his daughter, who, you know, went on to be quite a proficient director in this, is perhaps a misstep, because she does come across as someone who is not necessarily an actress. And again, I don't like picking that apart, but it's kind of noticeable it most times that she's on the screen, I thought. Now, maybe that's mean. What was your take on this movie in general? And why do you think it is that people haven't leaned into it as a worthy third part to this series?
So I fully agree on Sofia Coppola. Now, the other factor in this is she's very young. She's like 18 when this film is being made, 19 when it comes out.
Yeah.
And she's surrounded by megastars, like, you know. And also her dad, and she doesn't want to let her dad down. And it's almost like a time she's trying too hard. But I agree with you. Like, she's a brilliant director. Like, she's a phenomenally good director. But she's not an actress. And it does kind of come through that, you know, she's been cast because of who she is rather than what she is. But there's a couple of things with this. So, first and foremost, the first two films are based on a book. There is no book for this one. Yeah. This is a screenplay. And the second thing is, people had waited so long for it because The Godfather Part 2 is 74, were 16 years later. So there'd been such demand for this film for, you know, 16 years. As soon as Godfather 2 was out, people were clamoring for 3. And Capella didn't want to do 3 because he was like, no, it's a two-part piece. Like, that's the book. This is the film. These are the films. And that's it. We're not going to do any more. That's just it. Accept that as what it is. So I think people had gotten notions into their head about what this film would be when it was announced that they were going to make it. I think it had some problems in the production stage as well, with just, you know, different people wanting different things and whatever else. But I just think the expectation, the lack of real source material, and the fact that it was never going to live up to the first two. And people, therefore, were always, no matter what, were always going to judge it harshly. Like, whatever chance a sequel has of being better than the original, have we ever seen a film where the third one is the best? Because I'd struggle to think. I mean, maybe some of the Marvel stuff, I don't know. But for me, like, this was never going to live up to the other two.
Yeah, it was a big ask from the start. And look, what it has in common with the others are these hefty casts. So Al's back, Diane Keaton's back, Talia Shire is back, Andy Garcia comes in, Eli Wallach, who's great to watch in anything, Joe Mantegna, who you can watch in anything, Bridget Fonda comes into this one, and Sofia Coppola is there as well. There was initially, Winona Ryder had been cast in that role, and I think perhaps that might have been a different kettle of fish. And it would have been one of the things that people were beating the film with, that you would have had to dismiss immediately, because I can see her exactly in that role and being really excellent in it, that stage of her career.
She was phenomenal at the time.
She was.
Like in those, because didn't she make Edward Scissorhands, and she made Beetlejuice, and Edward Scissorhands then comes out. And she's like, I think the same year as this.
Yeah, and she's working with Scorsese and Day Lewis and making that Edith Wharton film or the novel that's turned into a film by Scorsese. She just has it at that point. So it's an unfortunate thing. I think she just was, I don't know, it was something about stress or exhaustion or something. Anyway, that's what led to the casting of Sophia. But, you know, and you mentioned the fact that there's no, but obviously Mario Puzo is the author for the original novels that the initial one and two were based on. But what I did like about this, you know, if one and two were gritty in the sense that, you know, they showed that at the heart of politics, you can reach in and you can see that most politicians, no matter how high level, are controlled, puppeted, exposed by their reliance on information not being released. In other words, you had in those early movies revelations of the sort that we have heard in recent years with the Epstein thing, you know, the whole sexual blackmail thing. That's touched on in 1971 or whatever it is in The Godfather. So you have those kind of like political corruption. You've got the gambling industry and how that works. It was really interesting to get an insight into that. But the one thing I do like about Godfather 3 is that there was the reference to the death of John Paul the First.
Yeah.
And then also the Vatican banking scandal, which is something I've been massively interested over the years, and God's Banker and all that. I've watched endless documentaries about this. And, you know, anyone who knows anything about the Catholic Church knows that essentially, you know, and you and I were brought up in the heart of it. But the more you read, the more you understand that it's a terrible set of lads who are, you know, originally built off the back of the Roman Empire so the Roman Empire could continue. And that greed and that, you know, desire to accrue wealth never left. That's been at the heart of it ever since. And I did like that angle, and I did love the fact that there was the good cardinal who would take Michael under his wing. And yet the good cardinal is heartily aware of what Michael is and has been, and here he is conferring confession upon him, you know. So it's a, I think there's a complexity to the plot in that regard. There's a couple of things. The Sofia Coppola thing was one. The other thing was a couple of the bad guys, like the twins. I'm not sure what I thought of that. You know, I just, as the henchman guys were like, there was a few bits about it that just, it felt a bit hokey or something. Yeah. Not really in fitting with the incredible heavyweight nature of those first two films. And it's not that you don't want to see this stand on its own feet and have its own life and be a different thing, but they were the negatives. But the positives almost entirely center around Al. I think his performance in this is absolutely magnificent. I love the sort of grey flat top haircut that he goes with. I think it's fantastic. It's a weird look, especially when it's paired up with those sort of sunglasses, and we can see him taking them off and his eyes are weak, and you know, he's this aging decrepit man who's beginning to wear his sins on his physicality. And I love that. I think everything about his performance is magnetic. I watch him and Diane Keating sparring over and back and their little moments of reconnection all day. I think there's some magnificent stuff about this film. It's just that around the edges, it's not quite consistent, and that's probably what kicks in the arse.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, I think he is brilliant in this. I think Andy Garcia is obviously excellent in it as well. I think, as I said in the last episode we did, I think if this had just come out as, you know, a mafia film and not Godfather 3,
yeah,
people would have been a lot more enthused by it. And, like, let's not forget, this film was nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards. So by no means a flop or anything like that. It's just literally because it's compared to the other two. Now, there's an edited version that Coppola says is the real version that came out in 2020, I think. And he has said that was the original vision. And both Pacino and Diane Keaton have both said, like, that this is actually what it should have been. This is better, like. So I think oftentimes, like, the problem, especially back then, was that the studios still retained too much control over the final product. And the most famous example is probably Once Upon a Time in New York, where they absolutely butchered Sergio Leone's classic for the cinematic release. And if you see the director's cut version, it's very different to the garbage that came out in the cinema. And it's incredible. But the one that came out in the cinema is not nearly as good. And I think similar things have happened here, where Coppola's probably put forward what he wants, and yet the studio have gone, yeah, well, we're going to change this and we're going to do this and we don't like how this looks. So we're going to, do you know what I mean? Like, so, like, it's not just the actors, the director, the crew, etc. You're also at the whim of, you know, at the time, stuffy old white men sitting in offices thinking they know better than the people actually making the films. And I have a feeling there was quite a lot of argument over the making of this film, and because what came out, Coppola wasn't happy with.
Yeah, and like it still has that 2 hour 40 plus running time. And you know, it's an interesting concept to see, to think about what might be the original director's vision for it, as opposed to what the studio insisted on in the end. But you know, I think there's more good than bad with this much maligned flick, and the best part about it is Mr. Al Pacino in it. And I'm going to say to you right now, Dave, on the fly, and tell me to run off and take a flying jump if you like, but we do like to actually basically show people how the sausage is made when we're making our shows here. We're 20 minutes in here.
We're only doing the 90s on this episode.
Let's do up as far as 99. That okay with you?
Yeah, absolutely. Then we can do a part three for 2000 onwards, and
because there's TV in there and stuff like that.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And there's some really good TV that's worth delving into. So, and the 90s, like, this is an unbelievable run through the 90s.
It's I know they're bigger hits and they're more profound and they have greater artistic heft and merit and all the rest of it in the 70s. But I think this is his most successful spell, and these are movies that more people remember. So it's worth our while spending a bit of time with them and sitting with them. And that brings us to 1991, where there are two films, and it's going to be a short little chat this about 91, because Frankie and Johnny is a really interesting Al performance, because he's not like a battered cop. He's not a mafioso. He's just this likable guy in a blue collar job who's in the middle of a romantic relationship with Michelle Pfeiffer. And it's an interesting film. I think it got him a lot of plaudits for people seeing a different side, people being charmed by Al Pacino in a way, particularly I noticed a few female critics charmed by Pacino in a way that is different this time. He doesn't have that brooding menace that he has in other films. It's an altogether more likable individual, an ordinary bloke. And I think he got a lot of kudos off the back of Frankie and Johnny. And I am anxious to hear your take on that. But just so we set this up, we're going into 92, where there's two movies we have to talk about. And one of them we're going to do a whole show on. And yeah, we'll spend a bit of time on now. But just Frankie and Johnny, for you, a success in terms of Al's...
I love this film. I think this is really, really good. This is obviously them getting back, Pacino and Pfeiffer back together after Scarface. And whereas in Scarface, she was very young and still, I think, trying to find her own way. And Pacino really carries that film. I think in this, it feels like they're kind of equals in this one, you know?
Yeah.
And I think both of them give great performances. But like you said, with Al here, there's a newness to his performance that I don't think people thought he was capable of. And I think it's really refreshing. And I never realized that this was based on a play written by Terence McNally. And would you believe who plays the character of Frankie? Now, bear in mind, Michelle Pfeiffer, probably at this time, the sex symbol of all sex symbols.
Yeah, go on.
Would you believe who plays... I'm going to give you two guesses, and I guarantee you don't get close. Well, maybe you will. Who would you say plays Frankie in the play?
What was the year?
1987.
And it's someone who works in movies as well.
Oh, someone who's very, very well known. And we've actually mentioned her in a recent podcast.
Oh. 87. Who were the big 80s megastar? It wasn't Sigourney Weaver, was it?
No.
Go on, tell me.
Kathy Bates.
No way.
Kathy Bates played her.
Wow.
F. Murray Abraham, obviously another absolutely brilliant actor, plays the Johnny character. But Kathy Bates, so, you know, like going from F. Murray Abraham to Al, fair enough, can absolutely see that. But from Kathy Bates to Michelle Pfeiffer is a very different type of casting.
And this is a very different type of movie for Al,
a
real departure. And like, you know, working with Gary Marshall, favorite for, you know, likely if you're listening to this and you're male, probably your girlfriend or mother's favorite film, Beaches.
Yeah.
Gary Marshall, who also did Pretty Woman. This is going to be a very different type of thing. Yeah, I think it's a lovely sort of addition to the Pacino catalog in terms of showing a different side of him. But if you've ever watched an Al Pacino movie, you're not surprised by this. I mean, if you've watched Sea of Love, you're not surprised by this. He can do the charming thing. Everybody knows that. He's like, we know that he has comedy chops if necessary. You know, he can sell a line. He can do the romantic lead. So it's not a shock. And It's I think in a kind of almost like a palate cleanser, because then he gets into two more, I guess, more traditionally Al roles.
Yeah.
In 1992, and you mentioned this before we hit record here about how 1992 might be a tough year for any other actor to emulate, because back-to-back he does Ricky Roma in Glengarry Glen Ross and Frank Slade in Scent of a Woman, which earns him his solitary Oscar in 1992. And we decided that when we discovered that both of us have on our Rushmore of films Glengarry Glen Ross, that we were going to do a show on Glengarry Glen Ross. And when eventually we get through with this owl crack, that is next on our hit list. So let's just put that in abeyance, except to say that it's bloody wonderful. In almost every way, it's just like an acting masterclass from all these wonderful heavyweights bouncing off each other. I just love it to bits. We'll get there with that. We're going to have its own. It's going to have its own separate tribute. And Ricky Roma, I mean, Al is just so cool in that. He's just a really he looks cool. But again, it's back to the darker side of Pacino. Yes, charming on the outside, but he will fuck you up, kind of, if you cross him. Frank Slade, however, is, you know, obviously his Oscar role. So for some people, that will be the definitive role for Al Pacino. I know that when I saw this first, I was very enamored with it and him. But it's interesting in that it's a performance which embraces all of the what would come to be so well known as the decade played out and the rest of his career played out, the Big Al.
Yeah.
He's Big Al here.
Yeah. we get, because the rant in Glengarry almost tees up the rest of the career.
It does. Like
that's the first real this is Big Al moment.
Yeah.
And then there's this Big Al production where everything is delivered with gusto. But at the same time, because of the character, there's that vulnerability to him. You know, he doesn't want the help, but he needs the help. But he wants the help in his way. You know, I take your arm, you don't touch me.
Yeah.
Like this, I love this film and I love this performance. But I feel like, do you know the way Denzel got Best Actor for Training Day? And it's a good film and a really good performance, but you're like, he's had better and he didn't get it. Yeah, this to me feels the same way. Like he's had better performances and it felt like he was given the Oscar for more of a body of work than just this film. But I do love this film and like there's great comedic moments in it. There's fury in him. There's real heartbreak in this movie as well when you hear more of the backstory about him and the different things. But some of the lines in it are just incredible. And the scene where he just arrives for Thanksgiving dinner and then proceeds to take over the whole thing. It's fantastic. But again, you're looking at this small, frail, blind man, and yet there's that explosive scene where he lifts his nephew up and pins him to the wall, and there's like real rage in it, but then there's also this sinister thing where he's very calm in how he speaks and he's explaining this ranger chokehold that he's doing. You're like, you're pinning a fella to the wall, you've just leapt from your seat and in one movement pinned this fella to the wall. And yet it doesn't appear like your heartbeat has moved at all. So you're clearly a terrifying individual.
I mean, there's so many set pieces in the film. You're right. You know, everything from the tango scene to the driving scene to that one you mentioned. The
driving scene is brilliant.
Fantastic. And
you've got to tell me earlier. I want to go now.
And
just brilliant.
The courtroom scene, obviously, perhaps.
Yeah, that's the thing. That scene, like, it's just incredible.
You're out of order, etc. Yeah. I think, do you know what? In answer to your sort of query earlier on as to why it's this one, it's probably because you can't ignore this performance. Mm. And you know, I think out of curiosity, I went to see who he was up against that year, and it's Cousin Bob for Chaplin. And to be fair, that is quite epic in terms of performance, and you know, the production itself had a lot of critical approval. he's up against Clint Eastwood for what I think is Clint's best role in Unforgiven, a movie I'd love to do a show about.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Stephen Ray in The Crying Game, which was much talked about, much vaunted performance at the time, and Denzel as Malcolm X. So,
It's a phenomenal, competition between them, isn't it?
That's a good year right there. And to come out on top, I do get what you're saying. It's like, is this actually Al's Academy standard performance? But I think yes, because it's almost as if he emerges from the chrysalis now into like what we're calling Big Al, is this guy who's going to. He is going to chew the scenery. He is going to steal the scene. But anyone who's ever worked with Al will tell you that, you know, like I was listening to Colin Farrell chatting about him, and he's like, he just talks about what a generous guy he was to work with in scenes. And, you know, Farrell's sitting there, you know, and he's in one corner of the set and he's looking over and goes, like he actually says, "Good Jesus, that's Al Pacino over there." You know what I mean? I love the fact that
Colin Farrell, when they worked together, is not long out of Ballykiss Angel.
I know.
And all of a sudden, he's staring across at Al Pacino. You know,
So I guess what I'm saying is, you've got this guy who I think this, ironically, this decade, this movie in particular, is what launches him, because the Michael Corleone role at the start of the decade is a continuation, albeit a bit of a departure from the previous iteration, obviously, because the years passing. And then you've got Frankie and Johnny, which is something that he could have done at any stage of his career, but it's more of a role that I've imagined young Al playing in the 70s. This here is where we get, like I say, superstar Pacino, the one that sort of burns himself onto the retinas of most people in one of these many roles that we're going to talk about. And holy shit, we roll straight out of Scent of a Woman in 92 and into Carlito's Way in 93. Now, I remember when I went to cinema to see this, and I was really excited. It's a new Al Pacino movie. I could not be more excited. And like you're talking about the age at this stage. So I was 40. So he's 53 here, right?
Mm.
He's 53 making Carlito's Way. He looks cool as fuck. And he has the beard. Then whether he's dyed or not, who cares? He's got the big old impressive mane of hair, and he still looks he looks quite youthful in Carlito's Way, in a way that I think he's this is what I'm trying to get at. It's almost like it's a new stage of superstardom for him in his 50s, where he still looks good, he can still do the romantic lead parts, and Carlito's Way, like, it's a superstar performance. With working with a really good director, it's a really tight story. His producer partner Martin Bregman's there through all of his big hits. He's supported by a frankly lunatic performance by Sean Penn, which is wonderful.
Brilliant.
Penelope Ann Miller is the female lead in it, but you've got lots of other fantastic players in it, like Viggo Mortensen in a role that I will never forget as Laling, who comes in, like that scene where he comes in the wheelchair and he's talking, "I gotta piss through a bag," you know, he is fantastic in it. But one of the guys who kind of steals the show is Luis Guzman. Obviously, John Leguizamo is fantastic as Benny Blanco.
Yeah,
I just love Luis Guzman. He plays Pachenga. And there's something about that guy that he's just a natural in front of the camera.
I love him. He's brilliant.
Because he's such a ordinary looking dude, he's always a bit out of shape and he's a bit wild looking and he's hardly movie star handsome or whatever. But that means he can just chameleon his way into whatever character role you want him to play. And I think he's fantastic in this, as is Leguizamo, as is someone like Viggo Mortensen as well. It's a tight story. It's well paced. It's very, very sure direction by one of the best in the business as well, Brian De Palma. And I just loved everything about this when it came out. Are there a few bits that are a little bit sort of cliche, cheesy Hollywood? Yeah.
Yeah.
But do I care? No, I didn't. It was tremendously entertaining stuff.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, there are some cliched moments in it, but like, it's just part and parcel. You just accept it and you move on. This is Al at his very best. Like, he's brilliant in this. And like you said, the cast is tremendous. And I'm really, really glad that you mentioned the performance of Luis Guzman, who I just love. I mean, you started watching NYPD Blue. So I decided, well, that sounds fun. So I'll give that a rewatch. And he's in that as Hector Martinez for a couple of episodes, and he's incredible.
Yes, by the way, let me cut across you and be very rude. Did you also see pre-terrible set of lads Michael Rappaport in one of the early episodes as a kind of street hoodlum? Almost unrecognizable, because he's not like the potato-headed gimp he is now. But anyway, sorry.
But absolutely a point well made.
Cut you off in your prime.
No, the thing is, like, for me, I saw NYPD Blue years and years ago, and I didn't really remember Luis Guzman from it. But what I really do remember him from is Oz, where he plays Raul Hernandez, and he's incredibly powerful in that as well. But this, like you said, he's the face for radio, to be polite. Like, he doesn't look like a fella that should be an actor, because you kind of have an idea in your head of what an actor looks like. And this fella doesn't look like one, but he's so good, and he can just adapt to whatever he's asked to do. And he just, if he's in it, like, you know, you're getting a good performance. He doesn't do bad performances. And this is a good film. Like, it really is. And Sean Penn is tremendous in this. Like, as you said, he's just like, it's everything good about Sean Penn in this role.
I believe this is how the story goes, that it's not like a bald cap and a wig. I believe that he actually plucked his forehead for that role. And I like that weird fro that he's got, receding fro that he's got. It's brilliant. And like, he is unhinged in it. And that's the thing about Penn, for a guy who's gone on to be such a po-faced sort of virtue signaler, he does actually have the capacity to be very effective. I really like him in something like U-Turn. I saw him recently in a TV show where he was like playing this astronaut guy, and he has that intensity to him that he is very watchable. Mm. And in this role where he's just, you know, off the rails, lunatic level, coke fiend, I think he's actually fantastic in it. And really, it's a great balance between the two of them. I love the evolution of the Charlie or Carlito character as he moves through the movie. It's a superstar performance of this new Big Al variety, even down to the like slight quirky voice that he puts on with the accent and the little exacerbated lisp and stuff like that. It's lovely, consistent kind of portrayal all the way through. But we're not done, you see, because that's 93, and Carlito Brigante takes a year or two off until 1995. Now, there's some movie called Two Bits, which I have no information about at all.
No, none at all. I don't remember that film at all.
All I know about it is what I can see here, that it's directed by James Foley, who's a very, very solid director. I'm rewatching House of Cards at the moment. He's directed loads of episodes of that. Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio's in it as well, who people will recognize from various big movies as well from the 80s and 90s. But I know nothing about it whatsoever. It's obviously a small enough kind of a production. However, 1995's Heat is not. And for a lot of people, you and me, I think in particular here, right, guys who venerate the 70s superstars and the people who emerged from that scene, to be able to have these two boys coming head to head in the shape of De Niro and Pacino, that's one thing. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And by the way, at this stage of his career, De Niro just looks ridiculously well. I think he's probably at his most Hollywood handsome at this era of his career. Do you know, when he's a younger guy, he's got that sort of like very almost like ethnic look to him. He's very much, you know, of the the Italian community extraction. He looks like he fit right into whatever sort of genre pick you're doing that has, you know, a mafia guy in it. But at this stage of his career, he just looks ridiculous. He's got that gravitas, obviously, because it's Bobby De Niro as well. We've already said Al looks like a bit of a superstar, although starting at this stage to maybe mold a little bit into that bedraggled sort of crumply suit guy that we start to see very much in the next decade anyway. But the cast here, man, the cast working under Michael Mann, who is top three or four directors for me that's working today. I love his stuff. I love how it looks. I love that. That's the one thing about Michael Mann, is you can be sure it's going to look amazing, and there's a certain feel to it. It's going to have a certain maybe seriousness to it that a lot of people might find a little bit jarring. I like it. And the cast of De Niro, Tom Sizemore is fantastic in it. Amy Brenneman as the kind of love interest for De Niro's character, who you have been seeing in NYPD Blue, obviously. Yeah. Ashley Judd's in it. We've got Val Kilmer in his heyday in it as well. John Voight, Ted Levine, who we spoke about on our last show, and Wes Studi as well, who's fantastic, and McKelty Williamson as well. It's a ridiculous score, and Diane Venora, who's the person in the relationship with Pacino's character. You could talk for ages about the story, about the set pieces. We all know the diner scene. It's been done to death. We don't need to rehash it on this show. We're trying to maybe take things from a slightly unique or individual perspective here. But I will say to you that in 1995, this kind of meant an awful lot to me. I'm, what, maybe 22 or something like that. I'm in the middle of my attempts to 21, 22. I'm in the middle of my attempts to really have a go at this stuff. And this was like a kind of religious experience for me, going to the cinema to see these two guys. And it's weird because they're a certain age, but they feel like they're in their prime. And that's why I'm going with this. This is like a new Al. It's a regenerated Al, a superstar Al. And you're hanging on his every words. And yes, we very much get big Al here, you know, the you know, whole thing about when I see asses, a woman's ass, and he's got the eyes are glowing and the hands are big, and it's almost comical, but he's doing a bit, and he's doing a bit in the role of being the detective who's cross-examining a witness at the time. And I think it's flawless. I know a lot of people think it's a bit big, but I think it's flawless, Dave.
No, I think it's perfect. I think it's absolutely perfect. Like, he is Al Pacino playing Al Pacino as Vincent Hanna.
That's exactly
that conduit he's got there. The scene for me that steals this film, like, obviously the diner scene is incredible because it's the first time that we see these two on screen together ever.
Yeah.
Like, they've been in The Godfather 2 together. They're not in the film together, though. But the scene for me is the scene with Ralph.
I love it.
Shut up, Ralph! Sit down! Like, goes from 0 to 100. I'm very fucking angry, Ralph. And he's like, "What? You can shag my wife, you can hang around her bullshit house, but you do not get to watch my television." And it's the shittiest little television. And he's furious. And he's banging it. And he's trying to pull it out of the wall. It is just like it's the Big Al explosion. It's so good. And poor Ralph. I'll just leave. Sit down, Ralph. I don't need to say anything else. Ralph is sitting down and he's keeping his mouth shut from then on. It's just brilliant. But like, this film is perfect. Like, it's perfectly paced. It's a long film as well. Like, it's the better part of 3 hours, but it doesn't feel like it at all. Like, you know, sometimes even with good films, if they run this long, you kind of start, you know, looking at your phone or you start thinking about something else. But this is brilliant. This keeps you locked in the whole time. And there's just so many brilliant scenes, well paced and well spaced out. Like the shootout scene is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
And Kilmer with the Uzi, like that in itself is just an iconic image of Val Kilmer facing down all these cops and just letting rip with the Uzi. And it's just like perfect, absolutely perfect.
The only thing that jarred with me was the Diane Venora character. It's not because she's not a good actress, but I think the dialogue that she was given was almost impossible to deliver. There's a scene where her and Al as Vincent and Justine, I think it's his third marriage, right? I think he refers to that in the diner scene. The downslope, I think he refers to his third marriage. She's given this sort of really difficult dialogue to talk about how he, you know, you go out there, you sift through the detritus, and you know, then earlier on with the Ralph thing, she's like, you know, I had to sort of whatever it was, like humiliate myself with Ralph, and it's overly formal or something, it's overly academic, it doesn't seem to fit the movie. I just thought it was jarring. It was the only thing in the whole movie that jarred with me, was who wrote that lady's dialogue, because it's not good. It doesn't fit, you know, because the rest of the script is so good. Even down to the kind of awkward bits, it should be awkward enough dialogue, but you know the Wayne Gross scene where he kills the prostitute that he's hired?
Yeah.
And he's talking about the Grim Reapers come to visit and stuff like that. And that should be kind of jarring, but actually really works in the context of it. And I love, there's so many brilliant scenes, like there's so many fantastic scenes, like none better than the diner scene in terms of the dialogue. And yeah, maybe it is a touch stilted, but where it gets a bit too stilted for me is in that Justine character. They didn't do her any favors there at all with those couple of scenes, because they're important scenes. They're, you know, about the dynamic of that relationship and why Vincent might make the decisions he makes later on. And it just, it's an unfortunate little misstep, I think, in it that always jars me every time I watch it. I'm only saying that because I have an opportunity to chat to you about it here. But we don't stop. We keep on freewheeling, unless there's something else you want to say about Heat.
No. Nope.
We'll step on your toes here.
No, because if we dig too far into Heat, we'll end up doing an hour on Heat.
We will. So we keep on freewheeling through the 90s here now. And 96 had City Hall, which is a movie that I've only ever seen half of. And now I know what I'm looking up this evening, because this feels like a little bonus that I've found for myself, an Al Pacino movie that I haven't seen all of from that 90s period. Are you familiar with it enough to be
able
to...
Yeah, I watched this a few months ago, actually.
You reckon I'm going to enjoy it?
I liked it. I did. Like, I mean, it's not one of his classics, but it's a good, solid film.
It's his director from Sea of Love. It's Harold Becker.
Harold Becker, yeah.
And
John Cusack is really good in it as well.
Yeah.
Bridget Fonda plays a good... is obviously always pretty strong. It's not a classic, but it's a good solid film. Like, it's a good solid 90s film that does the 90s by the book type of thing.
Yeah.
That you can just sit down and it's not endlessly rewatchable, but it's very rewatchable for sure.
Well, we put that on the shelf for now, seeing as I haven't seen it, and you've given me, you're not going to do any spoilers for me, which I appreciate. But when we get to 97, and we have, in this decade now, we've got four movies left to talk about, and each one of them could have an hour, as far as I'm concerned, for different reasons. But in 97, we've got two, and in 99, we've got two, and that's what's going to end part two for us, is our chat about these four movies. First up is Donnie Brasco, and then it's The Devil's Advocate in 97. So in Donnie Brasco, he plays this sort of made guy, this, you know, mafioso guy, this gangster guy, in his tracksuits and his sort of very modest living conditions. And it's a very interesting performance as Lefty Ruggiero alongside Johnny Depp, a movie that got a lot of, I think, critical acclaim at the time, and probably very rightly so. I did enjoy Mike Newell's direction. I'm always kind of surprised that Mike Newell hasn't been an awful lot more prolific in Hollywood, but I saw him interview Mel Gibson once, and the two lads had a big discussion about the dark side of Hollywood, including a very unsettling chat, which featured an anecdote by Mel about Chris Walken, where he described Chris Walken as almost like this satanic character who scared the living shit out of Mel. And I'm wondering, did Mike Newell therefore sort of alienate himself a little bit? He does get a Harry Potter movie at one point, I'm pretty sure. He got one of those. But in terms of the rest of his work, like, and you know, like, he starts off with, we must do a thing on Irish set movies at some point, because Into the West is his movie at the start of 92, and he does Four Weddings, and he does Donnie Brasco. He does Pushing Tin, which is Colin Meaney in it, I'm fairly sure, unless I'm mistaken. Mona Lisa Smile, and he does that Harry Potter flick. And he's kind of worked solidly, but not half as much as you would imagine a lad who's had a couple of massive hits like that would have worked. Maybe that's by choice. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. But this movie, I enjoyed massively. I never thought of it as a classic. What I thought of it was a really solid kind of genre piece in the gangster, overall gangster genre, undercover cop genre. You've got Johnny Depp doing a Serpico kind of thing in it, which is interesting, right? A role reversal thing. But again, the supporting cast, Michael Madsen, Bruno Kirby, who's always very good, and James Russo's in it, and Hesh is in it as Johnny Depp's missus, and, you know, a couple of other, Tim Blake Nelson is in it there, and Paul Giamatti as, you know, minor FBI heads. That's what tends to happen in these 90s movies. You're watching the scene, and there's some lad working a computer in the corner, and you go, hang on, that's so-and-so, you know? So this is what happens here. But I think it's a strong film, and again, I think it's based on a real life story of a guy called Joe Pistone, who was an undercover cop. And I remember enjoying the hell out of it, and I've rewatched it a couple of times. It had a certain cachet and cool about it, this one, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Depp in this film is very, very cool. He's, you know, he's probably at his most handsome at that point as well. The clothes, the way he carried himself, very, very assured of himself. But this is, like you said, it's not a classic, and it's one that is often held up as a classic, but I think that's a bit aggressive on it. But it's really good, and it fits really well into the kind of mafia genre. But again, Al is just brilliant in this film. Like, I love the scene, you know, like he kind of takes Donnie under his wing and he's explaining how things work. And I love that scene where he's explaining how, like, listen to what I say when I introduce people. If I say he's a friend of mine, that's one thing. If I say he's a friend of ours, it means he's a made man.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And that kind of thing is just really, really good. And again, like, It's a really good film with a really good cast, a really good director, like you said, and it delivers. Like, it doesn't try to be anything other than what it is. It's based on real events, so they have to stick, you know, close to the reality of it as they possibly can. And I think they do a great job of it. I genuinely do. I think Al as Lefty is great, and you know, you listed the cast, like, it's very, very strong. Poor Anne Hesh, I mean, she's excellent in this film. Like, obviously met a sad end a couple of years ago, but she was excellent, and this is one of her best performances, I think.
It's funny, because I was about to say, there's never really, from here on in, Al is that crumpled version of Al in almost every film that you see him in, whether it's Insomnia or whether it's in as Shylock and Merchant, or whether it's in something like Righteous Kill, or even to an extent, then obviously latter day The Irishman. But it's what, he's 57 in 1997, and sort of he sort of embraces at this stage that sort of more, like I say, disheveled older guy kind of presence on screen. However, 1997 also has his last effort at being that sort of larger than life, look at me, so not quite leading man, but you know, attention grabbing performance in the very very interesting film The Devil's Advocate. I'm really interested to hear your take on The Devil's Advocate. It's directed by Taylor Hackford and stars Al alongside Keanu Reeves and Charlize Theron, and there are a few other people like Craig T. Nelson and Jeffrey Jones. And it's basically an age-old story about a guy who basically sells his soul for career furtherment, and then his life falls apart, his relationship falls apart, and all the rest of it. Now, Keanu has gone on to become a much loved actor, and it's mostly because when he makes, a couple of years later, the Matrix film, he's cemented in everyone's minds as this, you know, central character in a film that a lot of people hold very dear. Up till then and up till now, he was this sort of surfer dude type that he traded off the Bill and Ted character. You know, Point Break. Like, I love that
Speed.
Film. Speed, right? So he's got this kind of action hero, but, you know, kind of vaguely airhead go about.
Yeah.
And here he's supposed to be playing this incredibly sort of proficient and skilled lawyer. And I remember thinking, this is a bit of a hard sell for me at the time. I remember thinking, oh, this is a bit of a hard sell. Since then, you kind of just accept, we've all seen the John Wick movies. Everybody loves Keanu now because he's just a lovely bloke. And
yeah,
in his own life, he does good stuff and he's got a hell of a lot of heartbreak to deal with. And I think everybody just has a lot of warmth towards Keanu, and he's effortlessly cool as well. But I remember thinking at the time, odd casting choice, you know, odd casting choice. I think he holds his own to an extent. But again, it just has that sort of, everything about his performance is quite Keanu of the era. You know what I mean? He is the film star Keanu, as opposed to slipping effortlessly into the role of the torn individual who should be at the heart of this film. But Al, does it get any bigger Al than this big Al?
No. He might. This is one that I think I've seen it twice. I saw it when it came out. I think I've rewatched it once since.
Okay.
It wouldn't be one of my favorite Al films, but I do enjoy some of the big Al moments. Like, there are a couple of tremendous raising of the decibel level kind of moments from him.
Yeah.
I think, like you, I think I just had a really hard time accepting Keanu Reeves in this type of role, because, like, I kind of put Keanu Reeves and Brad Pitt into the same sort of bracket, where they got their go because of how they looked. Like, as I was saying earlier on, like, you have an idea of how a movie star should look, and it's Keanu Reeves and Brad Pitt, like, fall into that. Pretty boys who fairly limited acting chops. Things like Bill and Ted suited Keanu Reeves because, like you said, the preeminent opinion of him was that he was a bit of a bimbo, or a himbo, I think is what the correct term, possibly politically incorrect, but the correct term is. Like, for me, I love the John Wick films and stuff, and The Matrix, which I'm nearly ashamed to say I only watched about 5 years ago for the first time. But I just couldn't buy him in this role at all. And maybe if I watched it back now, I'd feel a little bit different of it. But yeah, I couldn't buy him playing a smart guy. I just couldn't.
That's it. It's the line delivery. And it's, look, it's inarguable. Nobody can make a case against what we're both saying here. And, you know, has he gone on to sort of carve his own niche where nobody gives a shit about whether or not he has a very peculiar line delivery that nobody else has? Of course he has. And that's, you know, the sign of a proper movie star. It's the Connery thing, you know, you don't change the voice. It's the, we've talked about this several times. There's the movie star thing and then there's the actor thing. And I would say that I think several times throughout the course of his career, Pitt has shown that he can actually act the shit out of things. And you know, credit where it's due. And I think, you know, Keanu's absolutely found his own niche as well, where he can
It's like they became movie stars and then learned to act afterwards.
That's exactly the one. And in the middle of this movie, Al's there literally chewing every stick of furniture in every scene that's possible, holding his arms out, flames piling up behind him, talking about how God is an absentee landlord. And he's absolutely loving it. He's hamming it up. He's having the time of his life. And why not? He gets to this stage of his career. He's 57, 58. Someone says, hey, we want to do this sort of Faustian pact movie where you play the devil. Al's going, yeah, I'm in. Do I get to shout? Yes. Can I be Big Al?
What's the delivery? Frank Slade, but bigger. Bigger, Al. Much bigger. In every scene, go bigger.
You remember that women's asses scene from Heat? Bigger.
Remember when Ralph was watching your TV? That's a ripple in the water compared to what we want here.
The two lads are having the time of their lives, having great crack with it. It is what it is. It's a kind of a genre piece. Nobody can ever confuse this with a wonderful film. What they can say is it's good entertainment. And it's another big payday for Big Al. The 90s finish in 1999 with two absolute bangers in terms of performances from this guy. First, as Lowell Bergman in The Insider, again, based on a real guy, based on a real story. And then as Tony Amato, a fictional football coach in Oliver Stone's Any Given Sunday. Now, they're both very much top five performances for me from Al. And I know that's going to be controversial because people are going to say, well, what about all the wonderful stuff in the 70s, all the rest of it? But, you know, for me, both of these are right up there alongside Dog Day Afternoon and Godfather Part Two. I love both of these performances for various different reasons. The Lowell Bergman character, a classic late stage rumply Al, hassled, harried looking, pulling glasses on and off him, oversized clothing, big hair. This is the late stage Al in full effect. And when you see this film, if you have not seen The Insider, oh my God, you're in for a treat. It's Michael Mann again. So you know it's going to look wonderful. You know it's going to have that sort of heft and import. Michael Mann doesn't do comedy much, you know what I mean? If it does, it's incidental, you know, it's not a part of the general gist of the film. But Russell Crowe is outrageously good in this. You know, he packs on the pounds, and then unfortunately for Russell, they kind of stay on for most of the rest of his career there. He's obviously that way inclined, which an awful lot of people are. And, it's a shock, though, in this movie to see him like that, to see him as this sort of, you know, middle-aged, slightly portly gent who's a whistleblower against big tobacco. And the real-life story here is massively interesting. The idea of the 60 Minutes guy who Lowell Bergman, who Al plays, a real character trying to make this documentary about the tobacco industry, and Jeffrey Wigand, who Russell Crowe plays, who's the whistleblower, trying to bravely face up to this, you know, scary big industry. The concept, the premise is fantastic. The heartbreak that's all the way through it when things don't work out the way they should, the sense of betrayal when Wigand feels like Bergman's let him down and Bergman's really doing his best not to, and the politics of it all. I think this is just an outrageously good film, and Al in it, I think he's immense.
He is. He's absolutely immense, and it is a brilliant film. And it's, you know, we've been through what Al has done, how he's gotten to this point. But like Russell Crowe at this point is still very much, you know, trying to establish himself in Hollywood. He'd only really come across from Australia in about 95 for like The Quick and the Dead. I think pretty much everything he'd done beforehand, including the brilliant Romper Stomper, which if people haven't seen, I highly recommend going and watching, because it's an incredible performance. But like, he doesn't just compliment Al. Like, he pushes Al Pacino in this film to the very brink of his talent.
Yeah,
Russell Crowe's performance is unbelievable. And you know what's funny? You mentioned that he put on the weight, and then he did seem to keep it on for most of his career. But the next film Russell Crowe did was his Gladiator.
His biggest role ever. And you know, he's still, at this stage, I think, because I remember thinking, right, you're going to love this. I remember looking at the cover of Empire magazine in 2000, and Russell's there in his Gladiator kit, you know. And I remember thinking, fuck you, man. That's the movie I'm supposed to be in. That's where I want to be right now at this stage of my life. He's about 8-9 years older than me, I think. He's probably around 59 or so, 58, 59. And I remember thinking, Jesus Christ, that's exactly where I want to be, right there doing that. And, you know, the fact that he already had in his back catalogue, he already had the brilliant role in LA Confidential,
yeah,
which is like, that's just Bud White is a fantastic character, and we mentioned old Mike from Neighbors. He's fantastic. Guy Pearce is fantastic in that as well, and that was kind of, as you say, his calling card. The Quick and the Dead, though, that you mentioned, the Sam Raimi film, that again, if people haven't seen that, what tremendous crack that film is, you know. Yeah. Brilliant. And it's a director having fun with the camera and all the rest of it. And Romper Stomper, which was his kind of calling card, where he plays this neo-Nazi guy called Hando, a skinhead. Watch all of those. But here he is, as you say, 1 year before he gets into the shape of his life for Gladiator. Although, to be fair, he does it again for the boxing movie Cinderella Man, where he plays Jim Braddock, and he can't really get away with being portly in the Depression, like, to be honest. So he is in great nick for that. But this role in The Insider is incredibly powerful. And all I will say is that you've got this emerging superstar in Russell Crowe, who can literally act anybody off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
But you put Al beside him and put manners on anyone, like, Al's brilliant in this. You know, you just buy him. You buy his earnestness. You know, I know it's a bit of a cliche, and I know that the truth is probably a little bit different, and there's probably more things at play. But you really do, for the sake of the Hollywood narrative, you buy the fact that he's a good newsman. He's a serious newsman. He just wants to break the story. He doesn't want to let Jeffrey down. And the drama plays out around that, and it's great.
Yeah, it's an incredible film. And if you haven't seen it, of all the Pacino films, if you haven't seen any of them, I'd actually recommend starting there and then working your way. Well, there's one or two after, but working your way backwards from there. It is just, he's perfect in it.
I think that's
like you said, you totally buy him as this really, like, just a proper old school newsman. And for people that have seen The Newsroom, from what's the boy's name that did The West Wing?
Oh, Sorkin.
Aaron Sorkin. Yeah, his show, The Newsroom. Like, you could totally picture him as this character in that, in the role that Sam Waterston plays as Charlie Skinner.
Yeah.
And he's imploring his staff to be a fucking newsman. And that's what you glean from Al's performance in this as Lowell Bergman, like a proper fucking newsman who's just there to bring news to people, to break stories, to find out the truth. And yeah, like you said, there's probably bits and bobs in between that you'd maybe look at and go, well, that's not really the news. That's just you running an agenda. But at the same time, like, you just take this film for what it is, and Pacino's incredible. And like I said, like, Crowe pushes him right to the brink, like, you better fucking keep up with me, old man.
Yeah.
And Al is like, listen, you, I was making hits while you were still on the tit. So away to fuck. And I'll put you in your place, you know?
And you know what? You're not far off with your actual age and biographical accuracy or biological accuracy there, because, you know, Crowe's born in 64. By the end of that decade, Al's starting to
cook. And he's Australian as well, so they do things a bit differently.
God bless him. God bless him. We've got one left then for the 90s.
Yeah, this is a belter.
It is Any Given Sunday, and it's his role as Tony D'Amato. And again, this is one that kind of took me by surprise. Not necessarily because I wasn't expecting an Oliver Stone, Al Pacino combo to be good, but because I was expecting perhaps something that was going to be a lot different in tone. The cast here, again, is really interesting. Cameron Diaz, he was kind of bright new thing. But Dennis Quaid is brilliant in this. James Woods, Jamie Foxx, Matthew Modine. Freaking Charlton Heston pitches up at one point. Aaron Eckhart, who is brilliant. John C. McGinley, who's brilliant. And obviously then you've got the steady hand of Oliver Stone sort of guiding the story. And, you know, the whole movie for me boils down to the most famous scene. Like, I have it queued up here and I'm nearly tempted to just play it, but everybody knows the Inches speech, right? And to me, this is where, like I say, late stage, rumpled sport coat, big hair. Hasn't slept in a fortnight. Baggy looking eyes. That version of Al, who can be big if you want, but who can also do the kind of mumblecore version. And he's vulnerable. He's formidable. That's the thing about Al Pacino. He can be both things at once in the same film. And this is just a classic example of that. And in that speech where, you know, the chips are down, the guys are in, it's, you know, there's only half of the match of the game left, or the last section of the game left to go. There's disharmony in the ranks. And this speech, which draws on his own vulnerability, where he talks about how he's basically pissed all anything good in his life away, and the one thing that he can do is football, and that's all he's got left, and appealing to these guys to look to the guy either side of him, and he's going to be willing to go that extra inch for you, and what are we going to do? And it's like outrageously motivational. I do a thing with my transition year students every year where we talk about speeches, the best speeches and what's a good speech and all the rest of it. And invariably I end up playing them this, because it's something that young lads can relate to, because it's got that sport thing at the heart of it. But then also all of them are hit between the eyes by that vulnerability of the speech giver. It's not a guy going, come on, we're going to go out there and we're going to do this, we're going to do that, coming from a position of like authority and superiority. That's not what he does. He has this lovely vulnerability and fragility to him, and yet you're going to run through a brick wall for the lad. Now, not everyone could do that, even in acting, Dave.
No, not at all. And that speech actually reminds me a lot of the speech at the end of Scent of a Woman. Because the everything good in my life I pissed away is very similar to, I always knew which path to take, but I never took it, because it was too easy. The part about, you know, look at the guy next to you, looking at this younger generation, the same thing he does when he's pointing out that, you know, this young kid next to him in Scent of a Woman is the future. You need to give him a chance. You need to embrace him and nurture him. It's this thing of like, I'm this older guy who's made all the mistakes, so that the next generation don't have to. Like, they can learn from the things that I got wrong. Don't be like me. Go and do it a different way. And it's so powerful in this. And the thing with this film is, like, there's been a lot of great sports movies across the years. And this absolutely stands right up there with them. But this has, like, I remember when this came out, there was a feeling that this had, like, real legitimacy. Because one of the characters is Shark, played by Lawrence Taylor, probably the greatest defensive player in the history of American football.
Yeah.
The character of Monte, the defensive coordinator, is played by Jim Brown, maybe the greatest player in the history of American football. So you have those two giving it real gravitas as an American football film. And then you have this incredible cast of actors who are able to give it gravitas as a great film. Because, like you said, I mean, you've got Al, Cameron Diaz, I think, is really good in this. Dennis Quaid is, I mean, Dennis Quaid's very underrated, I think, historically. I think he's always a solid 7 or 8 out of 10. James Woods, I mean, I believe he's become a terrible set of lads. I'm pretty sure, certain he has.
And he is in this film as well. Like,
he is in this film.
He does bad guys well, right?
He does, yeah. Probably because he might well be one. But Jamie Foxx, like, for as an actor, as a singer, he plays a football player really well. Like, you can buy him as an actual football player. He has an athleticism to him. And this was maybe his real coming out party as well, because he'd done bits and bobs, obviously, The Great White Hype, The Truth About Cats and Dogs, Players Club. But he does this, and then, like you said, he goes on to do Ali. He goes on to do Ray, for which he wins the Best Actor Oscar. Like, this was really the launch pad for him. And you've got LL Cool J.
He works with Michael Mann, with Colin Farrell, who was earlier, I was quoting.
I enjoyed that film.
Oh, so do I. Listen, I will hear no slander about Michael Mann's Miami Vice. It's fucking fantastic. But the reason I bring it up is there's loads of stuff out on the internet about how Jamie Foxx, just initially he was referring to Al as the Scar Father or something like that, you know, thinking of him as some sort of amalgamation or a cliche of what he, you know, some sort of, as you said early on, almost a parody of himself. But he goes out of his way when he's getting awards to refer to Al Pacino and the incredibly powerful influence he had on him, just like Colin Farrell does as well. I just thought it was interesting the two lads end up working in a Michael Mann film, and we've spoken about plenty later on. Both of them, you know, massive stars in their own right, and both of them acknowledging the sort of, if not quite avuncular, but very much tutor-like, mentor-like presence of Pacino, which I think is a nice thing to hear about.
It really is.
But isn't such it a huge star, yeah.
That's the thing, and they're doing that while they're huge stars in their own right, and they're still remembering who, like, the people that helped them get where they've gotten. And I think there's a real likability in that, in having that awareness to always remember where you came from. The last person I want to mention that's in this is Elizabeth Berkley, who plays the call girl. And the only reason I mention her is because growing up, Saved by the Bell was a favorite show of mine, and that's where she'd sort of made her name as well. And she'd gone off and done some very questionable films, including Showgirls, which is one of the worst things ever committed to film. Do you remember you were talking about it was the first film that Chris Nolan did, and how film was film was expensive then.
Yeah,
they, like, talk about a waste of good money on film. Showgirls is an atrocity, an absolutely appalling stuff. But I mean, it was just nice to see her in this as well. But, like, everybody in this film gives a really strong performance. There's nobody that you look at and think, oh, you've let the side down there. Everybody comes out of this shining. So I'd watch this film over and over again. I think it's brilliant. And, you know, with Oliver Stone back then, you kind of felt like you were absolutely going to get gold. And he delivers gold here.
And yet again, surrounded by an impressive cast, under the helmsmanship of an impressive director, you've got, in the 1990s, Al Pacino being the biggest thing on the screen in every sense of that word, positive and humorous and slightly negative occasionally, if you want to be harsh on it. This is almost his decade. I mean, again, just to recap before we finish here, Dick Tracy, The Godfather, Frankie and Johnny, Glengarry Glen Ross, Scent of a Woman, Carlito's Way, Heat, City Hall, Donnie Brasco, The Devil's Advocate, The Insider, Any Given Sunday. Jesus, what a run. What a run that is. And it's like he owns that decade. He's huge. Probably, I would imagine, in terms of box office, his most successful decade as well. And it is remarkable that we've only now reached the year 2000, and there's a whole lot more to talk about in part three. But I think this is a good spot for us to wrap it. Looking ahead then to part three, just to tease it a little bit, there are lots of roles that I'm going to be looking forward to talking about. There are lots that I won't be able to talk about because he's done so much work in this decade that I haven't seen half of these roles. You know, I haven't seen them. You mentioned Mangelhorn earlier on. I haven't seen it. Danny Collins, I haven't seen it. I saw Hangman. I saw Righteous Kill, but I haven't seen 88 Minutes, for example. But what I can't wait to talk about is Merchant of Venice and his role as Shylock, where I think he's just outrageous. I'm looking forward to that. And I'm also looking forward to hearing probably more and being educated by you a little bit on his telly stuff, because I think you've seen Hunters and things like that.
Yeah.
And I do have to say, I'm really looking forward to finding out where you land and where we both land with The Irishman in terms of Al in it and the whole thing as a general sort of an entity that has almost too much expectation around it. He's also in this, like, recently he plays Aldo Gucci in House of Gucci, and that's, again, big name director and all that. This is stuff that I'm going to have to go and educate myself about before this final.
House of Gucci's decent. House of Gucci's decent. It's well worth your while giving it a watch. It's a really interesting story, and it's obviously based on real events as well. But you're right. Like, I mean, we've just done two shows on Al, starting with The Panic in Needle Park, because we didn't really do Me, Natalie. And we've run through to Any Given Sunday. There's 28 films there, right? Me, Natalie would make 29. So we get to the end of the 90s, he's made 29 films. Not counting Modi and In the Hand of Dante, which haven't come out yet, he's made 25 films since. And he's done five big TV things as well.
Yeah.
So he's actually done more since 2000 than he did pre-2000. Now, I know he's cut back on a lot of the stage work that he was doing, because he did a shitload of stage work in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And he's done a few bits and bobs since. So he did a run as The Merchant of Venice. He played Shelley in a run of Glengarry Glen Ross back about 12 years ago, maybe. He's done a few bits, but he has cut back on the theatre work, and instead he's gone heavily into the TV side of things while maintaining an incredible work ethic in terms of film.
Can I just say as well, because we can't let the 90s go past without mentioning the documentary that he made called Looking for Richard, which has a really special place in my heart. And I'm not sure if it's a thing that people are familiar with. It's basically, mentioned earlier on that he had played the role of Richard III on the stage. And this documentary is basically about him trying to make a production of Richard III. And it follows himself, and it also follows him in character as Richard III. So there are scenes that are presented to you in front of you. But it's a beautiful mixture between the actual documentary footage of the readings around the table, the rehearsals with all the various characters. I'll speak about them in a second. A recurring theme in it is something I just found this very interesting. 1996 again, a recurring theme of it is this idea of the American struggle with trying to portray Shakespeare. Are they allowed to do it? Should they do it? Is it okay for them to do it? I thought it was just a fascinating documentary. If you haven't seen it, like, it's so worth your while. Maybe I'm just given to all this actor lovey stuff, and I love all the behind the scenes stuff, but this one, it just tickled me on so many different levels. And the supporting cast, you know, the people who are nominally playing the various parts that he gets, that he wrangles into this whole production. He's got Penelope Allen, he's got Alec Baldwin, he's got Aidan Quinn, Winona Ryder, Kevin Spacey's in there as well. And they're all taking part in these table reads. And something about it I just absolutely love. I think there's features from a lot of big name theater stars as well, and, you know, Shakespearean Brits, you know, there's Branagh, Redgrave, Gielgud, Jacobi, James Earl Jones features. Kevin Klein is great in a couple of scenes as well. I just think it's a wonderful thing. It's a very different thing. You get to see a different side of Pacino. It's a little bit more vulnerable because you get to see that behind the scenes stuff. And I would heartily recommend that. Before we wrap up, had you actually come across that at any point, Dave?
Yeah, so years ago, probably around 2000 maybe, I happened to wander into HMV on Grafton Street, which I frequently did whenever I was in Dublin. And I picked this up on DVD and I didn't really look at it. I just saw Al Pacino and I saw, you know, like Alec Baldwin, Aidan Quinn. I thought, oh, it's a Pacino film that I don't know. So I bought it and brought it home and assumed it was a film and stuck it on and was initially disappointed that it wasn't a film.
Yeah.
But absolutely loved it then when I watched it. It's brilliant. And like you said, the fact that he just wrangles these people in and he's like, right, I'm doing this, so you're doing this as well. It's brilliant. Like, it is absolutely brilliant and was very critically acclaimed as well.
A wrangling feat only supported or rivaled by the great Jimmy Benet, I think you'll agree, in terms of the history of our show together. A tremendous point for us to end as well on 90s Al. What a decade, a supernova decade it was. Our third part of this show will be us discussing from that year, 2000 to the present. And like I say, you can expect Dave will be taking the lead on this because most of the TV stuff I will just know of theoretically. I haven't seen Hunters, etc. I've seen some stuff, but I'm looking forward to hearing about it and to talking to Dave and getting his take on it. We've actually managed to make this a three-parter. We thought we'd do an hour and a half and that'd be it. But no, you know, it's us.
There may well be a fourth part, yes. I wouldn't get too carried away. I think that we can wrangle that into an hour and a half or whatever.
We could honestly just do the TV as a separate part for it. We'll have to see how this goes. We will be in discussions and we'll get back to you. For now, though, thanks very much for listening to part two of our Al Pacino tribute special. There will certainly be a part three. Whether there's a part four or not will depend on how part three goes. That's how we roll around here. I've been Trev Downey. That was Dave Hendrick. This is Buzz Podcast. Talk to you soon. Sports Social Podcast Network.